Welcome to Awaken Calls. Every Saturday, we host conversations with guest speakers from all walks of life. Speakers whose personal journeys awaken and inspire our innate spirit of service. Thank you for coming together to plant seeds for a more compassionate society.
So thank you, Linda, so much for taking the time to join us this morning.
It was a great pleasure. It's great to be here.
To just kind of introduce Linda a bit, she's just, I don't know, reading about her and hearing about her and just talking with her a little bit, you kind of get the sense that she's this firecracker spirit who's kind of like this really resilient, you know, rope where there's, if you look at a piece of rope, right, it's kind of, you see all the threads woven together within it. And I think with Linda, it's almost like each thread is, you know, a strand of some experience from her life, whether she was, you know, growing up with parents who had this adventurous spirit, and instead of going to the beach during school vacations, they would zigzag across, you know, the country, stopping and talking with different folks and meeting people along the way. And like, she's originally from the UK, but she's visited 40 countries in 15 years with just one suitcase. And I think I'd love for her to share a little bit more, but I think it really came about her interest in going to disaster-torn areas and working as an aid worker in, you know, with countries and with people and communities during their worst hour, when she was in the mid-90s, when she was driving home from I think a sales conference. And she, at that point, she was a single mom and she was raising two kids and she was working a job that she wasn't, you know, that was just to kind of put bread on the table. And while she was driving, she turned blind at night, you know, in the middle of the highway, and somehow she managed to pull over to the side. And, but in that moment, you know, she really thought, wow, I really want to change my life in some ways. And so when her children were kind of grown and out of the house a few years later, you know, and her sight returned, and she later found out that blindness can be caused by stress, or temporary blindness can be caused by stress. But so when her children were grown a few years later, she decided to go to China, I believe, was the first place she went. And just as a volunteer, as a teacher and with her nursing background. And from there, I think she's bopped to so many different places and so many different communities. She was, you know, she showed up in Thailand, like, right after the tsunami hit in 2004. She showed up in Pakistan after this earthquake hit there. She's been to with refugees in, I think, Tibet, and been, you know, so many different places and so many different languages, so many different people, worked with people from, you know, the Dalai Lama and Prince Charles to, you know, the nameless, faceless volunteers that and community members that just populate our planet, basically, and has done so much to, I think, really give a hand up rather than a handout, I think is what she says. So we're really looking forward to hearing more about it, Linda, about all of it. Thank you so much again for taking the time to join us.
Well, that was a very great introduction, Audrey. Well done. You summed me up very well.
That's, you're so interesting. It's hard not to.
Very good. Would you like me to start?
Yeah, I mean, there's so many places we could start, but I think I guess it would be great to start with your journey as an aid worker. I know, I mean, I described it, but I'd love to hear maybe a bit more from your perspective of that moment when you kind of suddenly turned blind and you're on the highway. And can you kind of just recall, yeah, what was that experience? What was that feeling? And how did that shift you and shift the trajectory of, you know, maybe your priorities or where you wanted to go?
Yes, well, I was, when I look back over my life, I mean, I married when I was very young, when I was in my early 20s. And at the time I was in a career I absolutely adored. I was a nurse, and was a nurse for 10 years. And it was a job that every single day I felt that spring in my step to go to work. And then as life happens, I got divorced also at a very young age. And I was a single mom with two young children. And at the time, I realized that to be able to be the super mum that I wanted to be able to give my children all the things they needed, remaining as a nurse in those days was not going to pay all the bills. So I started to look for a job that actually earned me more money. And at the time, the pharmaceutical industry was looking to engage nurses. And it, as I looked at the job description, it ticked all the boxes. It was a company car. It was a good salary. It was regular holidays, no night duty. And I thought, I can do this. You know, this actually will suit me fine. I think I knew deep down that there was no call from my heart or my soul to do this job. But I took the job because it fulfilled all the financial requirements that I needed. So I started the job, and I found myself unhappy most days, but I could see my children were happy and I was paying the bills. And I might have come home and had an extra glass of wine or cried myself to sleep, but I just knew at the end of the day I was fulfilling my obligations for my children. And so I carried on until it got to one day when I was driving home from a sales conference from the north of England to the south, and it was a dark winter's night. And I was leading a very hypey sales conference and just desperate to get away. And little did I know that at that moment I was on the highway and the curtains came down and I went blind. And I really don't know how I ever stopped that car, whether it was intuition or angels, but I sat there on the hard shoulder just wondering what had happened to me. I was scared. I was angry. I was frustrated. I thought my life was over. I'd never see my children again. I'd never work again. And that fear and panic, it was way before the time of mobile phones. So I sat there in the dark and cold, just alone with myself. And of course, in those very dark, dark moments, I started to pray to a God I hadn't thought about for a very, very long time. And I said, you know, if my sight returns, I promise that I will find my purpose and my passion. And once found, I promise to follow it. And I sat there really in that heart-searching, soul-searching moment, praying with all my soul that I would get my sight back. And I was very lucky. My sight did return. It was something called hysterical blindness or stress blindness, which comes on through an overload of stress. And so this incredible wake-up call I had catapulted me into the next major stage of my life. So when I went home to my two gorgeous children, I shared with them that I realized that I'd become a very overstressed and very negative and unhappy person. And that for me to succeed in changing myself around, I really needed their help. They were still very dependent on me, and there was no way that I could just leave them and quit my job and do something else. So I needed to do something that only I could do, and that was to change myself. And so I set forth doing that. And I invite people to practice this exercise, because we are such creatures of habit, and we don't realize day by day if we're happy or not happy, and if we're expressing positive vibrations or negative vibrations. What I found I was doing was having the most negative conversations all the time, with family, friends, work colleagues. It was this constant banter of negativity. It was, oh gosh, the weather's really bad today. Oh, well, goodness me, it's going to be worse tomorrow. And wasn't lunch horrible? And isn't the boss just a nag? And I just found that I'd become the most negative person because I had put myself in a job that for me was meaningless. And so I had just immersed myself into being a very negative and miserable person. Very tough, a very tough moment.
And so how did you, what steps did you take to kind of begin, you know, how did you know you even wanted to go to, you know, volunteer and do relief work? And I mean, because you can do so many things when you volunteer. You could plant a tree, you can volunteer, you know, at a local school or something, but you decided to really go, you know, around the world and go to places when they're at their worst. How did you, what prompted you to decide to go in that direction?
It was a very interesting process for me, because once I realized that the only person, of course, we can ever change is ourselves. And so mm-hmm. I literally got my children to help me. And I said to them, well, I need to find out what my purpose is, what my passion is. But to start with, I have to change this negative person and lose her for good. So I said to my kids, there's going to be three words that we're going to eliminate from our vocabulary. And they are no, not, and don't. Can you imagine? Teenage children. I wasn't the most popular person. But the funny thing was, they were real team players. And they said, okay, Mum, we'll help you. And we had this swear box. So whenever we said the three words we were not meant to say, no, not, and don't, we had to put a pound in the swear box. And I tell you what, we had a very good holiday that year. But the interesting thing was, you know, and I realized I switched the news off for quite some time. I stopped watching the news because I was regurgitating every single thing that came on the news, all the bad news. And so I just, when the news came on, I filled it with dance music or comedy shows and just put in the positive where the negative was. I actually looked at the circle of people I hung out with, because as they say, you become who you have coffee with. And as I looked around at the group of friends I attracted, they were also very negative people. So I started to really look to actually communicate and hang out with positive, happy people. That also helped me. But during this time, I was really changing myself. I wrote a whole course called Emergency Zen. I wrote it because I managed to change myself around from being negative to positive within 1 month. And I really worked on it every single day. But simultaneously, I was looking to really find what my heart was pulling me towards. And it really was to help people again. But when I reflected on my nursing, I thought, do I really want to help someone in safe England, where we have good social services and good financial security? And I thought, no, my heart has been pulled to go to the places in the world where they don't have financial security or social security, where they're really living on the edge, where their health, their security, their fate, their fears are really there right on the surface of life. So there was one day when my son came to me and said, Mum, I really want to join the army. And my daughter came and said, Mum, I want to go to university. And I sat them both down on the sofa and I said, so is it time for me to leave home now? Because I realized my kids had found their dream. They'd found their passion. They'd found their purpose. And they were about to embark on it. And I then realized what my purpose was. And it wasn't being in England. So this is how I came to that point of selling everything I own in the world, selling my house, my car, my books, my paintings, and really leaping onto the front line with a full sense of passion and purpose, knowing that if I did leap, the net would appear and that I would be okay. Of course, we never know, but my heart and my soul was pulling me stronger than anything was stopping me. And so that is exactly what happened. And here we are 15 years later. And I still, at the moment, own nothing in the world apart from one suitcase. And it's currently here in America. And as you said, along the way, I've had the incredible honor to meet the most influential and powerful humanitarians, both the volunteers that join me and the celebrities and the well-known business leaders that I've met on the front line, but all great, great humanitarians.
Yeah, and I think just kind of learning about your work, it's really been about brokering relationships between all these different people, between, you know, humanitarians who are very influential, or regular volunteers who just want to help, or businesses who want to, you know, help support or bring aid in some way, but maybe don't have the local context to be that effective, and local grassroots communities and NGOs that, you know, want, you know, have their own perspective and positions in those communities. So I don't know, is there, could you share about maybe one of the places where you've worked and a little bit about how that how this kind of way of brokering relationships has come about and how it evolved.
Definitely. Yeah. I mean, the thing is, what I've found over the last 15 years is that really we have to listen to our hearts and souls, whether we actually go and help in any situation, whether it's in our local school or whether it's in a disaster area, or it's just helping to babysit for the lady next door who's got two young children and desperately needs a break. But I will tell you a story regarding one of my first visits overseas to a major disaster area. And it was during the Asian tsunami of 2004. And I was actually in Uzbekistan, which is one of the Russian former states. And when I saw this incredible disaster unfold on the computer screen, I realized that I had to go. What I saw was waves of 100 foot high, 240,000 dead, affecting 40 countries. Mm-hmm. But all I knew was that I had to go. And there was nothing else that I could feel but that sense of purpose. And when I got there, it was like a nuclear bomb had gone off. It really was a sense of complete and utter disaster. Resorts crumpled like matchboxes, cars thrown on top of roofs, glass everywhere. And as I knew that I had to get to this largest survivors camp, which was full of 5,000 Thai survivors, so as I got closer, I did feel rather overwhelmed by the sense of destruction and death. So I got out of my car and I walked to the edge of the cliff to take a good deep breath and a sense of calming myself down. And as I looked over and I looked at the sea, I wished I hadn't, because all I could see was a sea full of dead bodies. And I walked back from the edge of the cliff and I collapsed. And I had one thought in my head, and that was, I must leave this country as fast as possible. So as I sat there having my panic, my nursing matron appeared in front of me. And she stood there, very severe, in her starched white apron. And she looked at me and she said, "Nurse, this is not about you. You are here to serve. You are here to contribute." And as I saw her there, it took me back to my old nursing days. And it took me back to that sense of complete and utter service and contribution, which enabled me to get back into my body and straighten my back and take a large gulp of water and get back into that taxi and head to the front line. So never fear if you panic when you're about to do something. Take care of yourself and regroup. But if your mission is about service, something will always come to you to help you over that hurdle. So when I arrived in the survivors camp, it was nighttime, and I snuck into this communal tent. And the next morning, because I'm a nurse, I went to help in the first aid tent. And it was quite extraordinary, the level of trauma and grief that was there. But what worried me most was the number of children that had been orphaned. And there was one little girl particularly who kept pulling on my trouser leg. And eventually I said to the doctors, "Do we know anything about this girl?" And they said that she's lost every pillar of her life. If she's lost her parents, her brothers, her sisters, her teachers, her religious leaders. And this little girl continued to pull on my trouser leg, and she took me to an area where the children had been penned. Now, when a disaster happens, the great and the good arrive almost immediately. The UN, Save the Children, the Red Cross. But so do the nasties, the sex traffickers, the child kidnappers. And so as I looked at this area with these amazing volunteers from all over the world had arrived, they were taking care of these children, and they'd given them art to do. And as they were painting, these paintings were black because the grief was coming out in this really untold way. And as I was there, I had a text message from my father. And my father's a magician. In fact, I'm a magician. And what I realized was these children had to smile again, because whatever happens, the sun does rise the next day. We have to overcome whatever situation we're in. And as I thought of magicians and magic, I thought, I wonder if we can get a magician to come out to this disaster area and volunteer on the front line. Now, mostly when I talk to people about some of the things they do say to me, Linda, you are crazy. But never mind, I called back to London and I asked the Magic Circle if they would send out a magician. Because I knew that if a magician came, he would start to heal the hearts and souls of those children through smiles, through laughter, and through relaxation. And the magician came, and he stayed for 6 weeks. And he was the Pied Piper, this incredible volunteer who thought he had no skills at all to make a difference in this terrible disaster. But he was as useful as the doctor and as the nurse, as he came and made people happy and smile and start to recover emotionally and psychologically. An incredible thing. And really, when I think about how that started and psychological recovery started, it's something I've taken through all of my humanitarian career, because my main focus is to help people to rebuild their lives. And when I'm there, I'm looking to see how I can get people to earn money as quickly as possible, especially when you've had everything taken away from you, your house, your livelihood, your means of earning a livelihood. And many of the people that lived in this area worked in the hotel industry, and everything, every single thing was gone. The hotels were washed away, and they were not going to be rebuilt. Mm. So this is where I call on. Sorry, yes, please.
Go ahead. I think you're going. I was just going to say, so how did you do that?
Hold on, another set of volunteers, because I love volunteers. And this time, it was a set of volunteers who came from the business world. And I said to them, I need you to come and help me solve a problem. You're top people. You have skills in marketing and accounting. You're entrepreneurial. You have incredible business skills. Will you come with me to the front line? And will you talk to the people? Will you look at the geography? Will you actually look to see if there are any market opportunities for these people to rebuild their lives? And so these great volunteers came from Bangkok, and they came with me. And for just a weekend, they traveled to the worst hit areas that the tsunami hit. And they were superstars because they have a certain set of skills that I don't have. And they were able to look at the situation, find a market opportunity, and come up with a 10-year business plan of how these people could earn money immediately. These people were low educated. They couldn't relocate. So they came to me and they said, we have an idea, but where the wave hit, it still left acres of rubber trees. These rubber trees are standing. All the people need to actually harvest the rubber is a coconut shell, a knife, a rubber mangle. It will cost about $200 US to get a full community back up and running and earning money. When I asked the community if they had this would be a good idea, they came back and said, our grandparents always did this sort of work, and of course it's a great idea, and it's easy for us to do. In 4 months, they were earning three times what they ever earned in the hotel industry. That is what the gift that the business leaders gave me as volunteers. Another great example. And then at this situation, you know, 10,000 volunteers came from all over the world. We had them from 18 years old to 80 years old. We had the huggers. We had people come just to literally hug people. We had people come to clear up the grass, the glass from the beaches. We had 600 tons of debris on the beaches that 40 volunteers moved. The outpouring of love, unconditional love, compassion, that we are one world, was really overwhelming. And these people self-organized.
They self-organize.
So I'm self-organized. I'm a very big believer in never be a burden on a society that especially has been through a big disaster. So make sure you go with a tent or your own food. But actually what normally happens is that people want to feed you. They want you to buy a meal from them. You give them purpose if you're there. They want to take care of you. They'll open up their home for you to sleep in there. you become a community within that disaster. And that stops them feeling abandoned and forgotten. And that's a very big thing also. A bit like you're talking about your homeless person. You must always look at the quiet people, the silent people, the forgotten people. And it moves me on very quickly to what I'm doing in Nepal after the earthquake that happened there last year in April and May. This is now not like 8 months on. And the people in Nepal are forgotten because they had a massive disaster where a community I'm working in, 95% of the homes were destroyed and their livelihoods. Then no one has gone to that village to help them, and now it's 8 months on. And media defines disaster. Once the cameras are gone, we think people are okay. We think that they have survived and that somehow they will rebuild their lives. But in communities where they have no social security and no financial security, they have no ability to do that. And they will sit there having lost their livestock killed in the earthquake, and they have no idea how to replace it. It may only cost $60 to replace a goat. They don't have that money to be able to do that. Or $50 to replace a cow shed to help them to be able to have a shelter from the sunshine. They don't have that. So always we need to give them a hand up, not a handout. We need to give them ability to go back to being independent, with self-esteem and human dignity. And that comes from having economic empowerment. So that's a big thing for me at the moment. And if any of your listeners are at all interested in getting involved, I do have a website, which is wandaid.org, like the magic wand, WANDAID.org. And if you go to the event on what we're doing in Nepal and how we're operating, it will show you how we're trying to help the people there. And I must tell you something super exciting, because guess what? We have magicians coming. We have magicians coming with us to the front line. In fact, we're starting our magical tour here in the USA, because I am very lucky indeed to have supporters from the cast of Downton Abbey. It's a British television show. And one of the main actors in the show is someone called Jim Carter. He plays Carson, the butler, in Downton Abbey, an incredible character. And when I was with Jim and the team at Downton Abbey in Highclere Castle in the UK, Jim and I got talking, and Jim Carter is a magician. Who would know that Carson, the butler from Downton Abbey, is a magician? So there we go. So Jim and I got talking, and we also got talking to the executive producer of Downton Abbey, Liz Truebridge, and we started as a collective something called Wand Aid, WANDAID.org.
And we'll Jim, also email it out to folks afterwards.
So, Jim is here in the United States. Can you believe that? Jim Carter from Downton Abbey, Carson, is here. He's actually going to be here next week in the area of Boston. Jim is joining me to fundraise for Nepal. He is here between February the 17th and February the 21st. So please let your listeners know about this, that they've got the opportunity to meet Jim, hear about Downton Abbey, help Nepal, and see some magic. And
that's
we're at the Theatre in Portsmouth. We're at the Summerfield Theatre in Somerville, the Theatre in Arlington. And Jim Carter is volunteering.
That's great. And speaking of magic, I'm reminded of a story you had written about in your book about when you're in Thailand and you brought the magicians, and it was a big hit in the refugee camps. And then there's another group of folks in Thailand who are kind of removed from kind of the mainstream society there. But you managed to break those walls and bring the magic into their community as well. Can you share a little bit about that?
Yes, and I think this is always true. You know, it's all about, I've used magic all over the world to actually break down barriers, to make people curious, to even stop conflict. I've been in some really serious situations in Nepal during the Maoist time, and when there's two armies or two gangs about to fight, I will get magic out because it's fun and it's interesting and it's curious.
In the middle of two armies, you bring magic out.
Yes, totally. Because people actually, we don't want to fight. We want to be having fun and we want to be curious and we want to be interested in something. We've got to break through these things. And I did the same thing in that fishing village in Thailand. And they were called, they'd been labeled, as areas sometimes are, so if you're living in a poor area, they've been labeled as being the gangster area, a bit of the mafia. And, you know, I was advised, oh, no, maybe you shouldn't go there with your magician. And I thought, come on, you know, let's go and see. And actually, because as long as you're open and you're open heart, positive energy, and obviously we were going there to help, and they really welcomed us into their hearts and souls. And I think that takes me on to something else about fear. You know, if we project fear, then, of course, we'll attract it. We'll attract danger. And I've been in so many what would seemingly be dangerous situations, and I don't feel any fear. I just, because I'm going there for one purpose of helping people. And I've never had any moments where I've had an issue, really. So I think that's another key thing. You know, even when I worked in Pakistan, which was at the time quite a complex and difficult area to work in, it was after the Pakistan earthquake. But still, you know, as long as you wear their moccasins, you know, you don't, you dress as they do, you start to behave and become like them because you're a guest in their country. And then you learn to not make a big show of what you're doing. So instead of taking the big armored vehicle to the front line with the bells and whistles blowing, you take a battered up old taxi and you go as a normal citizen to help in a remote area. This is the way that we can, and that doesn't matter whether you're here in the US or in Europe. Wherever you go, if you're walking into a different community, just stop for a moment and think about who they are and where they're coming from, whether it's in a homeless shelter, whether it's an indigenous community that have their own ways, their own rituals. Be curious about it, understand it, and become one of them as you enter their community. So you bring all the stuff that you bring, all your gifts, as well as understanding where they're coming from also.
I think it's really interesting that you mentioned you've never really had a problem. Because I think, I mean, I know you've brushed death multiple times. You've evaded rape. You got a gash on your face and you stitched it up yourself. You suffered from hypothermia. I think you've faced some pretty extreme conditions. I think it's pretty remarkable that the way you look at it, it's like, yeah, everything always worked out anyway. So what enables you to keep bouncing back and running headlong into these, you know, circumstances, knowing that, you know, that you might be facing certain dangers, or maybe not dangers, but certain extreme situations?
Well, I think, I mean, to be really honest with you, it's the faces of the people that I'm helping. And always when you close your eyes and you can see the little children, the elderly, the mums or the dads, the families, who I know have been forgotten. All I know is I need to get up the next day and to move forward to help them. And I believe we have to take care of ourselves, of course, but actually it's not always just about us. And when we are born into a privileged society where we have a level of education and a level of social security and financial security, it's so great that when we can use our gifts and our skills to help other people. And so I do feel, for me, whether it's, you know, I have a beautiful family in the UK, and when I'm there, I really look to see who in my local community I can help, whether it is an elderly person who hasn't appeared at the supermarket for a while. Let's go and find out how he is. Let's go and find out if he needs something. it's always the quiet ones. That's what we're taught when we're nursing. The ones that are shouting and make a lot of noise, they're usually okay. It's the quiet ones. It's the ones that sit quietly in the corner that you don't notice for a few days. They're the ones that we really need to be alert for and to find out what's going on. But that's always what drives them forward at home and abroad, is to know that there's some small bit of difference that I can make to that person the next day in some way. And that can be just putting a smile on their face when I bring a magician, when I do magic myself, when I add sport or drama or music to a situation. There's always something in such a small way that each of us in our own way can bring to that person to uplift them just for that moment. And we never know the ripple effect that that has on people.
Right. Is there a particular moment that that really kind of made an imprint in your mind of when you connected with someone in that way? I mean, I'm sure you have many, many moments, but is there, you know, one particular moment that you really kind of hold dear in your heart, or one that's particularly memorable to share?
Well, yes. I mean, I have thousands, but I will, one I both, because I like to sort of show the diversity of where I've worked, and I did have some most amazing moments with His Holiness the Dalai Lama up in the high Tibetan areas. And it was helping an amazing charity that had realized that many babies were dying because they were unaware of something. And Tibetan nomads, if you start to even begin to imagine their life, they really only have what they stand up in. They usually own one set of clothes. They just literally have what they carry on them. Their jewels are in their hair, and around their waist is what they need for their day-to-day life. And around their waist hangs one knife. And this knife is something that they use to cut their yak meat when they're having their food. And what these Tibetans were doing high up in this Himalayan area is that they were also using this knife to cut the umbilical cord of their child. And inadvertently, they were killing their own babies because, of course, this knife was very, very dirty. And when you're looking to add value or change someone's life, all it took was for me and a group of volunteers to go up to this area and share this one piece of knowledge that was so simple to help save lives. Really very extraordinary. And again, people traveled from far and wide to share this message. And to see the smile on a granddad's face or a mother's face when they knew that they understood the reason why their babies were dying is extraordinary. We also managed, through this amazing charity, to involve the religious leaders there, the monks, who helped us to convey the message of using a clean knife. And they would do their religious rituals over it, pray over it, do a puja over it, encourage them to keep this knife clean and safe until it was time to use to cut the umbilical cord. Incredible. And that's why you never know your effect. You never know. But all we're trying to do is to share joy and happiness and the continuation of life in a happy and positive way. And we all have the ability to do that every single day we're alive.
Right. And that's beautiful. I think, you know, it brings to mind that the wide landscapes that you've seen. And I think, you know, in my experiences, you know, after such extensive traveling, I'm wondering, do you ever feel called to be rooted in one place? Or, you know, in some ways home is everywhere, and in other ways, when home is everywhere, it's also nowhere. And so where is home for you?
Well, I'm an absolute global citizen, that is no doubt. I mean, I feel the world is my home. And although I don't own a home currently, I have millions of places I can sleep all over the world. Most of them are refugee camps and places like that. So I never feel homeless. But I suppose because my children live in England, when I go there, of course, I have a very large part of my heart is with my children and my six grandchildren. So
oh,
I have
wow.
a lot of fun when I am with my six grandchildren in the UK. But I do feel, that's really again what I want to encourage people more and more to know that, you know, we are all so connected. And it doesn't matter whether you live in the, you know, the Amazon jungle or the Sahara Desert or, you know, the mountains of Colorado. You know, we all have the same value. We all want our children to be happy and healthy. We all want them to be educated. And we all need to really care for each other more. And I have chosen to work in the world, which is, you know, the 80% of the world that lives on less than $2 a day. Here lies another message because, you know, poverty doesn't equal unhappiness. The people that I'm with when I'm on the edge and the front line, you know, in the evening, they do have the ability to dance and sing and drum and share stories and over that lovely cup of chai. And, you know, sometimes we get lost in the first world in our material world where we have all the commercials and expectations, material expectations. And I also encourage people to really get back to basics about what is important in your life and what brings absolute happiness to you and your loved ones. And many, many years ago, I said to people, don't buy things, buy experiences. Because things will get old, break, disappear, you'll lose them. But if you spend your money on experiences, whether that's having a family holiday, a family vacation, or whether it's traveling to another part of the world, or whether it's having a day in the park where you'll have a picnic together with the family, that is making happy memories for the rest of your life. And that's what traveling so much has taught me, that your values and who you are can change many times when you see different levels of happiness and what brings happiness. When I noticed a young boy in Egypt who was playing with no shoes and a raggedy T-shirt and a pair of old shorts, my son, who was also 7 years old, gave away his brand new trainers and his Nike T-shirt. And he said, if he doesn't need one, I don't either. Look how happy he is. So traveling is very important, or at least moving out of your own environment and going to see how other people live. And that could be just to a suburb in your own town.
Beautiful. I just wanted to break in here, and we're approaching the top of the hour. So if you have any questions or comments or, you know, some of these experiences that Linda's talking about, go ahead and hit *6 on your phone. The Q&A is open. You can also email us at ask@servicespace.org, and we will do, at the top of the hour, we'll do a circle of sharing and some Q&A.
Great. Thank you. And while folks join the queue, I'll just pop in. I have so many questions, so I'll just keep going. But I think one question that I'm curious about is I'd love to hear more about how you nurture people's self-sustainability. I know when you go to these places and you mentioned, you know, it's really important to help these people kind of find their own way of, you know, earning their livelihood after, you know, their work has been destroyed or their jobs or their, you know, the hotels they worked in and, you know, after the tsunami and things. I guess how do you find, you know, I think you forge these deep relationships with people, and then in a way it's like you're a sower of seeds and you nurture the conditions for them to grow. And then once they're strong enough to kind of grow on their own, you let them and you kind of let go. And so how do you distinguish between, I guess, teaching a person to fish versus giving them a fish? Because sometimes it's not always so clear.
Yeah, I mean, that's very, very true. I mean, of course, you have to remember that lots of places I go to, people are absolutely destitute. They have nothing. And when people are like that, when you're absolutely rock bottom, it can, you know, you become more open to what you really need, what you really want. And so these very authentic conversations happen. And whenever I go to any community, like I'm going to Nepal in a couple of weeks, we sit with the people and we talk about their life, their ritual, what they want to do, what their skill sets are, what the land, what the soil is like, what will grow there, what they would really like to introduce into their community. Because often these very marginalized remote communities have never had much chances. And as we go in, I have a phrase called build back better. So they've already had a hand-to-mouth existence. So we go in to look to see how we can build back better. And so that could be, for example, the village I'm going to. It's very rich. If we can help to replace their livestock, which is what they want us to do, they would like to become a centre of milk collection and distribution because they're in a very good strategic position. We need to raise $2,500 for this chiller and a generator to operate it. But we know that if we can replace the livestock and then build them a chiller, which can then give them this credibility of being the center of a milk distribution, we'll get the milk companies get there buying milk, we'll really make the vibrancy of that community return. So, but we have to always engage with the village leaders, the youth leaders, the women. I always talk to the teachers. The teachers in most developed countries are the most honored people. Okay. So the teachers are always very, very important to talk to. And I tell you a secret. My secret is the person who knows most things that go on anywhere in the world is the hairdresser and the barber. Every single person shares their secrets to the hairdresser and the barber. So if you really want to know what's going on, go to the hairdresser or the barber, and that's what I do in third world countries to find out. And it's exactly the same here in the US and in the UK. We all share stories to that independent person who's doing our hair.
And wow.
Because you do. But you do have to immerse yourself in their world. And I take people on a whole course because I teach now humanitarian frontline working. I actually take people on an online course, and then they can come with me to the frontline for an experience. Jim Carter himself is coming with me to the frontline to Nepal doing magic. He's had his online experience. But what I'm saying is that basically we need to understand, I call it wear their moccasins. You need to understand who they are to really help them from the inside out with a hand up. So, and it is a process. And I've developed this incredibly successful structure for long-term sustainability over 15 years. That's why I feel very qualified to be the teacher of this foundation course for frontline humanitarian work, because I tell you, I have seen everything.
What is the craziest thing that you've been?
The craziest situation, oh, crikey, yeah. Well, I mean, one has popped to mind, which actually isn't very funny, to be honest, because what can happen when people go into a disaster area is that they want to change people, which is something I'm completely against. There was a very small Islamic community in Thailand when I was there to help them after the tsunami, and some beautiful missionaries had come in. But they had one goal, and that was to convert this Islamic village to a Christian village. Now, to me, that's not allowed. That is absolutely not allowed. You know, we all have our own beliefs, our own rituals, our own systems, and we can share with unconditional love and compassion, but we cannot go in and change people's belief system unless that's something they want to do. And so when I see that happening, it makes me really quite cross. And it's something that I will always raise awareness about, because we should all have that freedom of choice to be who we are and believe in what we wish to believe in. Yeah.
Right. Yeah.
So, Linda, I have some questions as well. One of them has to do with, I know, you know, like you said, you sit with people who live off $2 a day. And, you know, some people who've lost everything, they've lost their home, they've lost their community, they've lost their livelihood. But I also know you do work with business people and with, you know, large organizations like Nestle. And I'm wondering how you straddle that divide, right? Because a lot of people who work and serve, who work in humanitarian efforts, they often, you know, they can function at that level of helping these very, you know, poor people, but then, you know, that they don't seem to get along with the very wealthy, let's put it that way. Or they have prejudices about them, or they have, you know, reactions to corporations and things like that. But you seem to kind of effortlessly float across that divide, and I'm wondering how you do that and what your experiences are doing that and what transformations you've seen on the other side, on the side of large corporations or business people.
It's a very good question. And for me, I've devoted my 15 years to ensuring that the big companies and the private sector, business leaders, are engaged in making a difference on the front line. Because, and actually it was Prince Charles who taught me this model, bless him. And it's basically because if we don't engage them, we are actually missing out on the greatest jewel, because business leaders have so many great skills to bring to the table. And what I've learned is that we just need to facilitate that. So if they often feel that they're only used as a cash cow, their only use is to give money. And actually, they want to do much more than that. But we need to facilitate them. We need to say, you know, in this situation on the front line, can you please share your marketing skills, your accounting skills, your communication skills? Can you please help us to take this poor fisherman who's lost everything? We've replaced his boat. But he wants to learn now how to market his service better. He wants to know how to actually make the sign. He wants to know about health and safety. Do foreigners really like a life jacket? Because they don't use one. So we take their skills and we actually share them. And what they can see, a bit like my rubber tree story, very few charity workers would have actually come up with that incredible financial impact for that community. It took a very big business brain to do that and to also do the 10-year business planning for it. So we know, and I've seen it over and over again, that we need to build the bridges. And often I work with grassroots charities and large charities and the private sector to bring them together, because there is suspicion. There is mistrust, and we need to know that we each have very good skills, and also to be alert for each other. You know, even in the charitable world, the business world thinks that, you know, we waste a lot of money, that a lot of the donations that are given to big charities go straight down the toilet and doesn't reach the people. So they want to have accountability. They want to have transparency. They want to have the report. And that's something I've done from day one. I show exactly where the money has gone. I show where the effect it's had on the people, and I do it in videos. I actually show before, middle, and after, and show the uplift through the business intervention of how someone can just completely rebuild their lives. But I've also shown the private sector how well it works by volunteering. For example, KPMG helped do some volunteering, and they were giving their staff off a day a month for 6 months. And you know, KPMG is a very serious accounting firm. Very high qualified people work there. But they decided to be empathetic and allow their staff to volunteer one day, a month, or 6 months. But a very strange thing happened, because after this 6 months, the global chair of KPMG came back and said to these amazing staff. I was telling a story about KPMG, how they allowed their staff to have a day off a month for 6 months. To volunteer on the front line. And the result was their productivity of the company went up because their staff volunteered. So contribution is the greatest human need. If people volunteer, they feel good about themselves. And so even a hard accounting, high qualified firm like KPMG, their productivity went up when they started to volunteer. So it has, being of service, contribution is the greatest human need, and it has incredible knock-on effect in every area of our life.
Wow. I hope all the other corporations or large businesses are aware of that rise in productivity through KPMG from having their workers volunteer. Wow.
Yes. It's a very serious thing for people, companies to know. And I have had many great experiences with companies who now are starting to engage in a serious way and allow their staff to volunteer more because, you know, and I think, you know, university students these days, college students, they're looking for companies who are very committed to making a difference in the world and allowing them to have time incorporated into their companies to actually volunteer. You know, that's how I got to meet Richard Branson of Virgin. He's a great humanitarian. And you know, it's something that is really encouraged right through his whole company at Virgin to actually ensure that the staff don't give it lip service. They roll up their sleeves and they engage. And he leads from the front. He is a very big humanitarian. And I met him, you know, where I met him was in Johannesburg, just in Soweto, in a very difficult slum area. And there he was, you know, leading the way and leading his teams and his staff. And, you know, that's what companies need to do. They need to stand up but recognize that I call it corporate social opportunity. Companies don't need to think that helping out is a responsibility anymore. It's an opportunity. We are all together. And allowing your staff to get out and help and volunteer is actually an incredible knock-on effect of opportunity for the company, whether it's productivity, whether it's having your staff coming in with a big smile on their face because they're contributing. But it's a win-win situation.
Yeah, there's another study that I heard about where they took two groups, and one group did exercise 5 times a week, and another group did volunteer work 1 time a week, and they found that the group that did volunteer work 1 time a week was healthier and would probably live longer than the group that exercised 5 times a week.
Wow.
And you know, you come to mind on that. I mean, I can imagine your grandkids going to school and saying, like, my grandpa, you know, in Nepal, yeah. My grandma, oh, help clean up that hurricane. My grandma, you know, and it seems to me you have so much life in you, Linda, and I'm wondering if you feel that vitality coming out through, obviously, through your volunteer work and through, you know, being of service.
Most definitely. I mean, I never need to take a holiday because every day is a joy. But it's like it's driven by a passion, of course. And I think that's why another thing that I always say to people, if you're not living your passion, get out, because that is the slow death. If you're not in an environment or if you're not in a work situation, you know, that you're not really having your passion filled with, you know, really satisfied. Because, I mean, that's why, I mean, I do feel completely full of energy and vitality and life, and I feel joyous, and I do wake up in the morning and you know, sing thank you from the heights, because I feel such gratitude and appreciation about, you know, the position I've been in to be able to make a difference to hundreds of thousands of people's lives. But equally, I feel, I mean, to be here in the United States, I mean, it's a very privileged environment, and just to be able to sleep in a warm, comfy bed and have a shower, and then to be, as I mentioned, next week with, you know, Carson from Downton Abbey doing three shows. How crazy is that? And I'm a frontline worker, you know, and I can't wait to be in Boston next week and be with the people and share with them in this beautiful country of yours. And, you know, and I'm excited by that. So, yes, I do have the most amazing richness in my life. And And then when I, the people I meet, and I think that's the great thing as well, it's, you know, I'm rushing up to Santa Barbara now for a fundraising event again for Nepal with a lady just thrown her home open to say, I'm going to invite my friends in. I've got two amazing Dap Nabi actors coming with me, Mrs. Patmore and Mrs. Hughes. We're heading up to Dap, up there for this fundraiser for Nepal. And the people that come together there will be, I know, beautiful hearts and souls. There'll be people from the business world, from the local community, who know that if they are there, they'll either go onto my website and they'll donate to buy a goat or to buy a cow, or they'll share their skills with me and they'll say, I want to help you with social media. I want to help you with marketing. Can I give you a bed for the night in this hotel? Can I pay your airfare to go to Nepal? It can be the smallest or the largest, but we're all so connected. And I know that people don't all want to give up everything like I've done to be on the front line, but you can support those people through me or through OneDaid that Jim, Liz, and I have set up. And I know next week in Boston, again, the communities that we're going to, a homeless shelter in Boston. We're going to these amazing theatres, the Music Hall in Portsmouth, the Somerville and the Regent Theatre in Arlington. I know the people there will all have a gift to give. Maybe there'll be magicians there that want to come to the front line. And this is what excites me, that always you come across the most beautiful people that in their own way will want to help. Someone might even buy me a cup of coffee. I would love that.
But there's a comment from your hometown.
Oh, yay.
London, UK. It says, I'm visiting Nepal with Linda and WandAid in a week or so. Great to be involved. Listeners may want to know what and how they can be involved in making a difference, both as an individual and as a part of their corporate business. This is such an important time to do what we can, and Linda's work gives us a great opportunity to do so. I'm going to try to listen in from London. It's 5 p.m. this year and a wet, cold, gray Saturday. Your broadcast will bring a ray of light. Thank you so much for setting this up with Linda. XXX Robert.
Oh, yes, Robert, actually, he's voted with his feet. He's a very senior nurse in the UK, and he wanted to actually come with me to the front line because I've set up something called Be the Change. You know all about that. But Be the Change, leaders on the front line, because if you can spare anything between 3 and 5 days, it doesn't take a huge amount. Anyone needs to have a long weekend. Come with me. Look at the website. As I say, it's WandAid, as Robert said, WandAid.org, or my own website, lindacruz.com.
And we can email all that out also.
Come and see us. Come and, like Robert, it is time. I do feel it's time to, and never, ever feel I don't have anything to offer. Because I tell you, I have the huggers. I have the people who do the circus skills, the people who like to kick a ball around, the magicians, the actors, the business leaders, the mums, the dads. You all have something to offer. And just we get connected with that passion and that heart vibration. And that's where the magic is. And that's where you can cancel that gym subscription. And then all you have to do is live your passion.
I'm curious, Linda, amidst all this activity, do you have is there a personal practice or how do you stay grounded?
Oh, yes, I do, of course. And I think what I've been so lucky with is because I've lived in the most, countries that are really engaged with being your best, but being spiritual and really engaging with nature and the environment and appreciating whether it's the warmth of the sun or the goodness of the river flowing along by your paddy field. And so, you know, I've learned the rituals of every religion known to man, from the Islamic religion, from Buddhism, from Hinduism, from Christian, from indigenous communities, from Native American Indians, I have learned from refugee camps. I've learned from, and I tell you what, I do wake up and I bless that morning. And I will light some incense. I'll light a candle and I'll say a prayer. And I will carry something with me which reminds me of opening my heart and remembering my family. I take pictures of my children and my grandchildren and my grandparents. And it's just remembering constantly to be in touch with the wonderfulness and the magic of our beautiful world. And I have rituals when I wake up and I have rituals when I sleep. Most of them start with thank you and end with thank you. And that level of gratitude and appreciation and joy and, yeah, I mean, I my day is full of these rituals, but mostly, and that's why I wrote Emergency Zen, my course, because I tell you what, there is so much we mustn't lose from these Indigenous communities. They do have a much happier existence generally than we do because they have understood how to really engage and live their day-to-day life with all of this, plugging in all of these little rituals and habits that we can that make our day-to-day lives 10 times better. And it took me to have that massive wake-up call and go blind and understand what these rituals were. But I tell you what, from being 15 years on the front line and having my own kick up the arse, basically, to stop being a negative, miserable person, I put it all together in Emergency Zen, and I know there's a very, very easy way to live our purpose and passion and to have a sense of joy and happiness every single day. And I'm a very ordinary person. I came from a very ordinary background. My family were very ordinary, and this is what I managed to do. But anyone can do it. Anyone.
Wow. Beautiful. I'm gonna start right now and just thank you for that blessing and for that wisdom and that you've gathered from so many different cultures and so many different religions. Thank you, Linda. We actually have a caller that wants to ask a question. Let me unmute them.
Hi, everyone. This is Mish calling in from bitter cold, and I do mean bitter cold, New York City. Linda, it's been delightful and inspiring listening to you. Your enthusiasm is so contagious. And I just wondered if you and Jim Carter would be visiting New York City while you're in the States, because I would love to share hugs with the both of you. I'm a big fan of Downton Abbey, and I adore Carson, and you'd be more than welcome to stay in our home. And and the huggers, I mean, everybody can hug. And but just this morning I saw this quote. They said they invented hugs to let people know you love them without saying anything. So you can hug in any country, in any language. Everyone, you know, understands what a hug is. And I'm wondering, how prevalent are huggers? Do you take a hugger team with you when you go to disaster areas? And again, will you be coming to New York City?
Well, so lovely to talk to you to start with, Mish. Thank you for the call. Well, it's really interesting because I've been blessed to have this amazing group of celebrities. So I've been just blessed to have these incredible actors like Jim and others from Downton Abbey join me in this quest to help forgotten families. This time, we were invited to come to Boston. And as I said, we're in those three theatres, the Arlington, Summerfield, and Portsmouth. But invite us, please, to New York, because we are going to be in the USA. We've already been invited to Georgia and Alabama, and we are on a quest to come as a team. So there'll be me, Jim, there might be Mrs. Patmore, Mrs. Hughes, and other actors that are so behind me, and even the executive producer of Downton Abbey. Because we've come together in one day for good to help forgotten families.
And what kind of venue do you need to be invited to?
Well, I tell you, in Boston, we've got people throwing up in their homes and inviting 30 people. We've got these big theatre gigs. We've had Unity Churches invite us in. We've had people invite us for a high tea.
Wow.
And actually, we're leaving people up to your imagination. In Georgia, we're going to be going to Sea Island, which I understand is a big venue. So we are open to anything and everything. And
okay.
Please give Mish my contact information.
Yes, because you'd be more than welcome in our little home. I would love to have you here.
So please do stay in touch. And anyone listening, wherever you are in the United States, we are now, we'll be in and out. And we really want to bring the joy and the fun of what these lovely actors are doing. And many of them are magicians as well, by the way. But they've also got great hearts. They're huge humanitarians. And they want to meet people, share the stories, of course, of Danton, share the magic, and come to your backyard.
Wonderful.
Hop on the train, Mish, and meet us in Princeton. I want to meet you. Come on.
I'll send my nephew. He lives very close to Boston.
Good, good. And then invite him. You know,
okay. Thank you, Linda. Bless.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Linda, Nayana Tara's question came through, and she says, I'm so impressed by your ingenuity in bringing inspiration and self-nurturing. We are lacking in the way we nurture many of our suburban youth who have everything and find no reason sometimes to work or even live. What do you suggest we can do to inspire them to find their passion? These youth are also the silent, forgotten ones, in a sense.
Mm.
Yeah, well, I have so much empathy with that. And I think, you know, what we have to do is building those bridges. So we have to create a safe, fun, interesting environment for people to come together. So if you're aware of an area, a suburb, where people are really lost and purposeless and passionless, and you are keen to connect with them, start to do your research about what actually excites people in that area. And I tell you what, often it comes through something like sport. So it could be football, it could be basketball, it could be hockey, it could be something like that. But engage, just do your research about what actually excites them. And that is just the first platform to get to know them. Because you've got to create a platform, which is a level playing field, where you're all looking, dressing, acting, eating the same. And it's from that level playing field when you start to understand people's purpose and passion. And sport is something that is a real leveler, and also people are fanatical about. So I would encourage you to do massive research on your area you want to help, but equally start to build a bridge on something that has a very common denominator like sport, and then start the really in-depth conversations from that about what people's passions are and what they would like to do. And then the magic happens, because then you can start to link them and connect them with companies, business, organizations that can help them to grow. But you've got to start way before then with this level playing field.
Mm, beautiful. I know, Linda, I know you have to leave right at the end of this, so we have one final question for you.
Yes.
And how can we at Service Space, how can our community, how can all our volunteers, how can we serve you? How can we help you out? What can we do?
Well, yes, please, and thank you for asking. Because, I mean, if you can be part of my communications team, so, for example, you heard me mentioning these places in Boston. I would love those to go up on your website so people know if they come, they have the ability to see us and also to have amazing experience and to donate. For people to be part of the larger communications world, there are many of you bright young things out there. You're great at social media. Can you join me on Facebook and on Twitter? You know, look up one day. Look at what we're doing. Be part of the community. Actually, and if you're able, come on the front line with me. Come and be the change. Vote with your feet. Sign up for a frontline experience. If any of you out there are part of the business world, I would love you to connect with me. I'd love to engage your organizations. I'd love to come and give a keynote at your company. I would love to be at your next conference to inspire your people to be all they can be. I would love to bring together a think tank of the most creative, innovative leaders to come together and help solve problems. And if there's nothing else, if you want to buy a goat for Nepal, it's $60. That's a few cups of coffee to go without. Go on wandaid.org, go to the donate button and buy a goat. And I promise you, I'll show you that picture when I get to Nepal in a week's time. There are so many beautiful things you can do. And the last thing is, smile at the next person you see, a great big smile, and give them joy. That would help me too.
Wow.
I'm smiling right now just listening to that.
Wonderful.
Yeah, thank you so much, Linda, for taking the time to join us in the middle of all these travels, waking up at 5 a.m. to make sure you can get everything done on time. And
my pleasure.
It's been a real, real gift to just get to hear all your stories. I think, as Mish mentioned, you know, your spirit is really infectious, and it really just comes through in the way that you talk, in the way that you speak, and there's an open-heartedness that I feel listening to you. So thank you for bringing the magic to our call, to our Saturday mornings or afternoons or evenings, depending on where we all are in the world.
Oh, well, that's my great pleasure, and it's been lovely talking to you. And thank you for letting this happen. And thank you for helping us with WandAid and really, you know, getting the word out there for us, because we need you as much as anything else, because we're just one big, gorgeous, wonderful team. So thank you so much.
So we like to end with a minute of silence, and then we have this ritual. Speaking of gratitude rituals, where we unmute everybody and we have a huge thank you. Thank you. And now I'm going to unmute everybody. And at the count of three, everybody send out your gratitude for Linda, for her beautiful work, and for all the magic that happened here. One, two, three.
Thank you, Linda. Thank you for listening to a recording of Awaken Calls. To access archives, visit us at www.awaken.org. And to get more involved, volunteer at www.servicespace.org.